Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a variety of fascinating guests discussing the human side and impact of crime, not only on their lives, but mine as well. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, please contact Lifeline or any other support service or person that you feel comfortable with. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and not everyone will agree with them. I understand that and I hope you do too. Thank you.
I felt like it was a game of chess, but unfortunately the pawns were actually people and they became arguably a little bit expendable if it meant that I could win the game of chess. And that's probably the best description that I can give of how I felt my police career, what it evolved into.
Dave Evans was a member of Victoria Police for 23 years. Until you guessed it, he was ill health retired due to what Dave would prefer to call a psychological injury, which I really like, but most of you will be more familiar with the term PTSI. And remember, it's an injury, not a disorder. Hence why I'm trying not to refer to it as PTSD. When Dave and I got chatting, there was something he said which really resonated with me. It really touched me. And to think that it was a man who was prepared to explain his feelings the way he did was just really incredible. Dave left policing because he realised Victoria Police's values and morals didn't align with his own. Dave began to feel the weight of encouraging a victim to report a traumatic offence when they were hesitant or didn't feel they could do it. The impact of requiring a victim to explain the most intimate, often humiliating and embarrassing details of, let's say, like a sexual offence in a statement, for instance, witnessing them going through a tough cross-examination in a courtroom, having to bare their soul to strangers, having the accused listening to every word they say, and after days and sometimes weeks of this, for the case to be dismissed or lost due to a legal technicality, it took its toll on Dave, as he was the one who had to pick up the victim's broken pieces. Dave would try to reassure them that they'd done a great job, but in the back of his mind was always the thought that he had encouraged them. He had maybe even persuaded them to go through this court process or the whole reporting process. The justice system has broken too many victims, but it also broke Dave. The day Dave realised he'd had enough is a really powerful story. Dave and I feel similar in our thoughts on the justice system. So often the justice system seems to disregard or even maybe ignore the victim's emotions and well-being. Too many in the justice system see their role in the court system as just that, a role, not taking into account the victim or witnesser who are the real people in this whole thing with genuine fears and anxieties. Yes, it may be just a job to them, but to the victim, it is the most anxiety-ridden, nervous, upsetting experience they will probably ever have to endure. And don't get me wrong, I've got some very, very dear friends in the justice system who I know show enormous care and compassion for victims, like most. But there are a few too many who see a victim or witness as a file, and they go straight on to the next file once that one is done and dusted. Dave went into psychology and social work after policing, and he's at pains to prove and encourage others that there are other careers outside of Big Pol, even when you believe there's nothing. Just ask Dave, and me for that matter. Thanks for your time, Dave, and my heart goes out to you. I believe you're a Ruse supporter, and for those the listeners, AFL is a constant with all of us, isn't it, Dave, all of us Victorians, but I'm feeling your pain because our coach has left as well.
Yeah, it's been a big few years for the Mighty Kangas. yeah, they've had a lot of instability with their coaches, and I think it's disappointing, but I guess that's the way things are, and it's a real game of pressure and expectation now, and
yeah,
I think
yeah.
It's taking its toll on a lot of people, players and coaches and the rest of the staff, I guess.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And what I really admire is the fact that there are now coaches who are saying, putting up their hands and saying, I need a break. I cannot deal with this. Mentally, I need a break. And I think how powerful is that for the community to hear that somebody like an AFL coach who we all look up to as strong, really passionate about their job, they'll do anything for it, but they know or they're beginning to feel a lot freer, aren't they, about saying, no, it's taking its toll, I need a break. It's a huge step, don't you think?
Huge. And I think I sort of look at, Alistair Clarkson and his standing within the football community. And I think, because, there's been other coaches who have perhaps left because of, the sort of they've run down or they're feeling overwhelmed by the whole thing. But I think because of his standing, it's really made a strong impact, I think, on the whole community in that. If somebody like him is prepared to make that decision and have the courage to step up and take a break and call it out for what it is, I think that gives a lot of people a lot of confidence to then perhaps come forth and do the same. Whereas historically, because of the type of game that it is and the bravado that's associated with it, it would have been very difficult. So I think it's a really good step in the right direction. And others have done it, but I think Alistair Clarkson, as I said, and now obviously even the Richmond coach has done the same. So I think they're two coaches who are very well-respected and influential in the fraternity of AFL. So I think it's hopefully going to support others who are struggling to come forward and not only step down if they need to, but at least get the support that they're looking for.
Oh, I agree. And I think it's a bit like, say, Graham Ashton, when he stood down from his role as Chief Commissioner with Victoria Police. I think that was a really powerful message to a lot of members that it can happen to the Chief, it can happen to anyone. And I think, as you say, it's a really powerful message that it is okay.
Yeah,
to put your absolutely. Hand up and say, I'm not managing. So, Dave, we could talk about football. In fact, I could talk about football ad nauseum, but we need to move on.
Yeah.
So tell us about your police career. Give us a little bit of an insight. You maybe a couple of places where you worked, maybe some interesting jobs that you attended, and for whatever reason, I imagine in 23 years, a lot would have stayed with you. Can you take us through a couple of them?
Yeah, sure. Look, I graduated and I went straight to Cranbourne uniform, which I kind of reflect on those years there and the people that I worked with and the culture of that station probably is the best years of my policing life. The senior members that were there, the sergeants and the senior connies, were just fantastic. They were really supportive. You know, they sort of gave you the opportunity to develop. And I think their culture there, when I compared it to other stations and stories I'd heard when I'd go back to the academy, whether that be the social culture or the treatment of trainees within this station, I think that it was a very healthy place to be and somewhere that really – I was fortunate. I felt really fortunate to be there. And, look, it certainly wasn't anywhere near as busy as it is now. But I guess the type of work was similar. And perhaps – look, there's a few stories that I could probably talk about insofar as the support that you did receive. So one of the when I very first got there, probably must have been my first few days, I think, and I think I was probably nervous to answer the phone in case somebody asked me the time, because I would have been like, oh, my goodness, what time is it? I was that nervous about the new role. But I remember a guy come in and he had a warrant, an outstanding warrant, and he came to me and I was on the desk and he explained to me that there was a warrant that he had to come in and get bailed and all the rest of it. And I was like completely confused, but I thought, oh, I better have a crack at this myself because I don't want to annoy everybody. So I went and found the warrant in the box that was there and brought it back to him and said, look, you know, we're going to have to just take you around the back and do some stuff. And he sort of went, oh, well, actually, I'm not really available at the moment. I've got a bit of stuff on. He goes, can I come back later? And I'm like, oh, I don't see why not. So I said, well, look, what about if I just give you the paperwork and you go do what you got to do and then you bring it back with you and we'll sort it out then. And I remember he left with it and I went back out the back and the senior connie that was there, they said, hey, what was that all about? And I explained to him what happened and he was like, oh, no. So anyway, there was kind of this mad panic, and they got onto him actually by phone, which was convenient. And it, you know, sort of obviously had a bit of a word to him about the situation, and he came back fortunately, and it was all resolved. But it was kind of like the way that they managed it. They didn't condemn me. They obviously had a bit of fun with it. But
I bet they did. Yeah.
And it was something that was, you know, spoken about for years to come. But it was a good example of how the members there really sort of did support you, even when I made such a terrible error. But it was there. It was really good. I enjoyed it there. That was probably, as I said, my fondest memories were there, and I still have some contact with quite a few of the people who supported me in that early development.
Dave, that makes a big difference about your supervisors, because I can remember an interview I did with a former member a couple of months ago now, and the first station that he went to was just so inept in so many ways, and he spoke of the laziness, for instance, and the laissez-faire attitude of so many of the members, that it really affected him to the point where he thought, nah, this isn't what I wanted. Like, just the difference and how important it is to have good supervisors and people, like you said, you could have been hung out to dry about that warrant issue, but they had, yes, they had a bit of fun with it, but you learnt, they obviously told you or explained to you what should have happened, and so next time it wouldn't have happened. But it's just so important, isn't it, to have good supervisors, people that are people, because to be honest, Dave, I don't know about you, but a lot of supervisors that I've found in my 27 years, they weren't really, they might have been brilliant detectives or brilliant police people, they didn't know how to manage people. Did you find that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why I really did like it at Cranbourne, because the senior members there were quite senior, sergeants and senior connies, and they really were people. as you've sort of expressed, and it made a huge difference because, I mean, you're sort of really vulnerable when you first join, I think, and you come into this job and, you know, you go through your training at the academy, but all of a sudden you kind of put out there with the equipment on and make these sort of huge decisions moment to moment. Mm. And without that support and I guess knowing that you can make mistakes and be supported through that, in that, especially, I mean, obviously, you know, if you make that mistake after you've been in the job for a very long time, then perhaps the conversation's different. But at that early stage, to be supported the way I was, I think it sort of allowed you to, firstly, it motivated you to learn more and understand the processes better.
Of course, yeah.
And I think that was partly because of the way you were, you know, the people there supported you to understand it. You went, gee, you know, I've got to get this right because it really does create problems for everybody. So, yeah, it was really good. But I think that was the key, is that they were just motivated to do the job properly but in a caring and compassionate way.
Mm. But also with that attitude that they had with you, it encourages you to learn and it encourages you to ask and not feel a dill when you don't know how to do something.
Yeah.
It's that sort of support, I'd have to say, was pretty rare, I reckon, in my career. You know, you asked a question and they'd go, "You should know that." Well, I might should have known it, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And so it made you very, very unsure of asking another question. So, I think hats off to Cranbourne. And Cranbourne, the main issues, would I be right in saying Cranbourne, for the listeners, it's south of Melbourne.
Southeast, yeah.
And would I be right in saying there's a lot of public housing down there, a lot of very vulnerable people? Would that be fair or not really?
Look, there's certainly, parts of Cranbourne. There's a lot of public housing. Obviously, it's expanded massively now and there's all those new housing estates. And but certainly back then, yes, it was a fairly, I guess, a small town really in comparison to the rest of Melbourne. And, yeah, there was a fairly significant area of social housing, and that, you know, obviously, as is often the case in that sort of lower socioeconomic areas, there's issues around, you know, family violence, antisocial behaviour, which happens everywhere, regardless of economic status. But it certainly was prevalent there, and I thought that the senior members really handled and dealt with the people in the area, regardless of their status, their social status. They did it with, in a way that really demonstrated quality and compassion.
Yes,
I thought
it was
a really good start to a police career. I thought I was very fortunate, and particularly like going back to the academy. And having conversations, you know, in that first couple of years with other squad mates and hearing some of the stories and just thinking to myself, wow, that's a huge contrast to what I'm sort of experiencing where I am.
Oh, yeah. And you then you worked in a number of, I suppose a lot of your career was down south, but when did you join Socket? Because obviously that is a common thread with both of us. I just love Socket. I love the work they do. I love what they stand for. Tell us about Socket. So you had to be a detective to work at Socket. So when did you become a detective?
Yeah, okay. So I guess my ambition probably from early on was to look at that sort of investigative role. And I did a few things along the way. But then I sort of found myself coming back to family violence and that real strong interest in Socket. And so to sort of get to that point of perhaps becoming a detective, I went and did some temps at a tasking unit. And predominantly we worked on sort of drug investigations and statutory offences, I guess. And being there and doing that was It was a really enjoyable sort of 12 months or so, but it certainly confirmed in my mind that I wanted to work with or investigate crimes where there was an actual victim as opposed to a statutory offence. And I know that there's multiple victims in you know, as a result of drug crime, so it's not saying that there's not, but I felt that the motivation for me came from working with individuals who were victims, survivors of crime. And so then that kind of basically led from there to applying. And by the time – so historically Socket well, I guess when Socket started, it changed from being a uniform operational member working at the Socket unit and then the detectives doing it, and it combined and became what was commonly known now as Socket. So I applied for a job at Socket and got it because I really wasn't that fussed necessarily about working just in any other areas as a detective. So it really was my focus was on going to Socket. So that's what I did. And fortunately, I was lucky enough to get a position. And it was a very rewarding role. What I found is that the things that I loved about it were probably the things that arguably became a little bit of maybe my downfall. I sort of look at it as a bit of a double-edged sword. And
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah,
it was like engaging with the victim survivors of the crimes that I investigated and, you know, building that rapport and really sort of having that professional relationship that is certainly next level really motivated me to investigate the crime as thoroughly as I possibly could, which was fantastic. But it also, in hindsight, and I didn't necessarily realize it at the time, it certainly meant that I was prepared to do things that perhaps they were legal, they were ethical as far as policing was concerned, but I don't think they necessarily aligned, which is you alluded to in your intro, my own values. And that sort of, we'll call it coercion of whether it be a victim survivor or a witness, being able to engage with them in such a way that you've developed a trusting professional relationship and then using that and other aspects of perhaps their personality and finding that sort of that button within them that would help them decide to become
bring
involved.
Bring them over the line.
Yeah.
Bring them over the line. Yes. Yeah.
And I just and I was doing that regularly and probably getting better and better at it as time went by and thinking I was doing a fantastic job, like really enjoying it, but at the same time slowly becoming more and more unwell away from that environment and, you know, bringing home, I guess, that inner guilt that I wasn't really even aware was there and managing it in ways that were very unhealthy, were unhelpful, were destructive to my personal life and my family. But at the same time, going to work ready to go again and being really motivated and enthusiastic because I just had no idea. And I recall just coming home and, you know, having conversations or arguments about everything with my family and just going to the office and thinking everybody is just out of step with what's going on. It was kind of like, I remember there's this picture and I've never been able to find it, but I remember I saw it one day and it's like this whole army and everybody's marching and there's one person who's like marching on the opposite foot. And that's how I felt. I just thought the world had become out of, you know, the whole world was out of step basically. Instead of seeing that it was actually me that was a little bit out of step with reality.
I know what you mean, Dave, because without a victim, or more so a victim, without a victim, you don't have a case. And I used to feel terribly responsible because if we didn't get the victim over the line to say, yes, I will give evidence in court, you and I both know, and a lot of people listening will know, how stressful court is and how it can really...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Muck with your head, you know, like, and I'm not talking about the informant because it certainly can with us, but I'm talking about a victim. And I think it doesn't matter how strong a victim is, it's a whole new ball game when they get up in a witness box, and I keep referring to the word hammered because I believe they were, and they were hammered by the defence, or maybe just tricked a bit into, because the defence was so good at getting a victim to a position where they had to answer something that maybe they didn't want to, it was just an awful, awful feeling. But without the victim, the crook got away, the offender got away. Did I just say crook?
Yeah.
The suspect, the person of interest, they get away with it. And that's what really stuck in my craw. I thought, oh, gee, it was an awful position to be in, wasn't it?
To stand there and see the way, victims, survivors, or witnesses were, I just think they were demoralized and humiliated often. And I don't know, I'm not sort of suggesting that it's a terrible system, but there are things that you see, and I guess that you're involved in it, and there's an exchange of emotion and to see the impact that it has on them and way that the system focuses on I think demoralising probably is the word that I feel sums it up best, and that sort of loss of faith and almost becoming a victim all over again. Judicial process is your line of defence or your last line of hope to justice, and it demoralizes you to the extent that it sometimes, I mean, look, it's, I'm not saying it's imperfect and I'm not criticizing it in any way, but unfortunately the way our justice system operates, it is what it is at the moment, and it's no doubt always being looked at and reconsidered and trying to be made, I guess, more compassionate to those involved in the crimes. But I just think that it sort of really is that becoming a victim of the system, which means you really have nowhere else to go. So what that does to an individual's sense of hope, it must be really sort of profound and significant.
Yeah, and really, in a way, I don't think we can get around it, that we are responsible for getting that victim to court, for taking the statement, for actually conveying them to court, to getting them into the witness box. And, you know, I used to be filled with dread sometimes because I sort of felt I knew what was going to happen. But, you know, and this isn't, sticking the knives into defence or prosecutors, whatever it be, because they have a job to do just like us. But I think we have to think more about the fairness. We talk a lot about being fair to the accused, and I don't have a problem with that, of course. But I think we also have to be fair with the victim. And I don't think it's fair that the victim's whole background is brought up. Sometimes, you know, their counselling, their sexual history. Yeah. I think we should concentrate more on the actual incident, the actual crime. And I understand why defence prosecutors, I understand why they go back to the victim's behaviour, but I just don't think it shows very little compassion. And I think for a victim to get up in a witness box, it's demoralising. Your sense of self-worth goes all out. It can do more harm than good.
Yeah. And that's the thing, and I think what you sort of alluded to is that fairness component of the process, insofar as we're going to look at every aspect of your personal life from day dot as the witness or the victim survivor, as opposed to actually we won't talk about anything to do with the the person who's supposedly, the suspect or who's on trial. It's kind of that in itself creates that sense of a lack of fairness, particularly in the eyes of the person who's up in the box being, you know, sort of humiliated for something that they've done years ago. And that all of a sudden means their credibility shot. So I think it's probably something that everybody knows is a problem, but how you get around it, I don't know.
No, I don't either, because it's been in, hasn't it? The justice system has been tweaked over time, but I don't think there's a lot more that they can tweak. But I don't know about you, but even giving evidence in court, whether it be a county, supreme, a magistrate's court, it doesn't matter. There's many times I have been humiliated and hung out to dry as well as an informant, and it makes you very, very anxious and nervous about giving evidence yourself, because you can do the best job in the world. But the defence job is to, find that little clink somewhere where you're not too sure about something, and, God, they just go for the jugular. However, I get that's our system, and it's nobody's – I don't know how we change it. I suppose it's just through, going to our local MPs and, talking about it like we are, I suppose.
Yeah, I think for me, like the system is what it is, and, I mean, having conversations like this no doubt influence potential change, but I think what's more important from my perspective, or just as important from my perspective, for members and those who are finding themselves involved in the court system, is to be provided with sufficient awareness of what's going to happen, and I don't think that necessarily happens. And I mean, even for police, I mean, I certainly reflect on my career and go, early on you went to the odd contested hearing at the magistrate's court. And, it was sort of challenging, but you're there rarely. particularly now with the, you know, the new systems that are in place with the court to streamline it and all the rest of it. So you're there rarely, and certainly it's not anything like what you are presented with when you start going to trial. And I think it's that lack of awareness and preparedness to all of a sudden be stepping into those sort of county court matters and seeing how it all unfolds, and seeing that I guess it's not always about fairness and justice. It's really heavily about the law, and then it's kind of, you feel a bit betrayed almost, because you go, "Wow, hang on a minute, what is going on here?" But and I suppose the other thing that I'll just touch on quickly is, with regards to all of that, is what I found, which was probably, you know, something that is an issue certainly to do with me, and not something that perhaps all members experience, but because of that motivation and desire to get a matter to court and, you know, collect the relevant evidence and all the rest of it, what those investigations became was a little bit about my investigation.
And
I think that in itself became a problem, because it was about me winning my investigation, as opposed to it's not about me and it's not about my investigation. In fact, it's got nothing to do with me. This is about the person who's come to me, and I, every decision I make should be in their best interest. But and I think part of that is related to, firstly, probably my own ego, but also related to the potential positive outcomes that come with successful prosecutions, insofar as your career, or the perception of that. And I think that probably was, and I said, as I said at the time, I didn't realise it, but in hindsight, I think that was part of perhaps my injury, is that the realisation that that's what I was doing. It was kind of like, this is a great job because it's got a, you know, it's got a lot in it, and if I investigate it really well, perhaps I'll look good. And I think that's a terrible way to approach any investigation myself, because it really isn't about my career or me. It should be a case of, I need to do the best job that I can for the person who's come and reported it to me, regardless of the outcome and whether or not it helps or disadvantages me and my career.
It's about figures, though, isn't it, Dave? Like, to become a detective.
Yes.
It wasn't anything about the victims that you dealt with.
No.
It was all about how many arrests did you make, how many court cases did you go to, how many crooks did you arrest. Like, it's all about figures. And, look, in a way, I don't know. I don't understand why it is so driven by the number of arrests, for instance, that somebody makes. You know, there's people, like, it's about people, and it's about people's emotions and feelings. It's not about bloody figures.
Yeah, but I think it's certainly that in itself is not, you know, just Victoria Police or the role of policing.
I think that's
something, you know, everything has to be quantifiable now. Kind of the way that we measure everything, as opposed to looking at the quality of the work you're doing as opposed to the quantity. And I guess they say that the quality is measured in the outcome, but I probably disagree with that, and perhaps the quality needs to be measured in a different way. And is the quality of for example, if you were to engage with somebody and be completely transparent about the process and your experience, sharing your experiences with the court system and all the rest of it, and then that person decides, actually, I don't want to go through that. That's probably, well, it's quantifiable because it's a person that is a victim of crime that hasn't been solved, arguably, and that's the problem. But if you look at it from the quality of service perspective, it's probably fantastic because it's allowing that person to have the concept of self-determination. And I'll make the decision whether I want to go ahead with this investigation, not you, because it's going to look good in your next application for a promotion or transfer sort of thing. And unfortunately, it's something that I don't think anybody goes into the job with that mindset or intent, but unfortunately, it's a little bit like that frog in the water that slowly boils. And the next thing you know, you're part of that sort of mindset and culture, because it really is beneficial in not just the police, but in all organisations.
I know that we're talking a lot about the struggles as an informant or as a police person, but on the opposite side, there are those just magic moments where you do, and it sounds like a game, where you do win a case, but just that euphoria that you see and how it changes the victim, particularly, let's say, how the victim just feels like they're 10 foot tall and yeah. It's all worth it. Like, it is one of the best feelings in the world when we have won the case and the magistrate or judge will say, remove the prisoner. Yes, there's a lot of negatives, but there's a lot of things we do that are just so wonderful to be a part of. And, you know, and I know you and I, we never forget that, and I hope others don't either, because it is a fantastic job. But you've just, again, we go back to it, don't we? We've just got to look after ourselves, and we didn't, which brings me to tell me, in Socket, it's a really tough gig, Socket, and I take my hat off to so many members. But in your Socket years, is there an investigation that really you're very proud of, or that you will never forget for, I don't know, a terrible reason? Can you share with us a job or an investigation that has stayed with you?
I guess one of the – look, there's a few, and I'll probably focus on this one only because it was a positive outcome. I think we've probably spoken enough about the outcomes that are not so great and why that is.
Yeah.
And the things that underpin those concerns.
Yeah.
But, and it was probably a relatively simple job, but it took a little bit of investigation, and the outcome was fantastic. So it was related to somebody who had followed somebody from a train and followed them back to their house and behaved inappropriately in their vicinity. So it was obviously of a sexual nature. And there was no sort of, you know, we just had this person who made the complaint and said it was this person, and I got off the train. So we kind of had a look at the train footage, and we got an image of the person, and so we kind of shared that around. And we had some calls through Crime Stoppers, and we had what we thought was a lead, and it turned out that it wasn't. So then we kind of thought, well, we better go back to the drawing board and see what else we can find. And so then we just kind of started looking at a lot more footage, and fortunately, I guess, we noticed that in one of the shots the person had a cup of coffee, just in a clear plain white cup. So that was kind of our thought, well, we better sort of see if we can't find who sells coffee in the area and have a look at all their footage. And so we started.
Oh my God, good luck with that.
Yeah, and that's what we did. So we literally started going to all the coffee shops, and of course it was almost sort of a long way down the track that we eventually went to the coffee shop that's open for like a few hours every day at the actual train station. It was just like a little kiosk. It wasn't even part of the station. It was like somebody had just got this little shack set up, and we went to them, and we sort of were getting to the point where I thought, I'm probably not going to be able to get much further with this almost. But then we went to the this particular gentleman in that store, and we said, here's the photo. And he goes, I remember the guys runners because they were brand new and they were like really white, shiny white, and you know, looked big on his feet. And I was like,
yeah,
that is unbelievable. So anyway, we used that, and then we sort of he sort of advised us if he was going to let us know if he saw him again and if the guy came and bought coffee, and then yeah, it sort of went from there, and we used that information to investigate things a little bit further, and wow. And eventually we caught up with him. He and I sort of look back now, and I can't remember exactly how we got to the address that he was at, because it wasn't his address. He was staying in like a little shed, like literally a shed. He was here on a maybe a student visa, I think, and yeah. Just living in somebody's shed. But somehow we managed to track it down to this address, and sure enough, we you know, picked him up and took him back to the office and interviewed him, and and I guess it was a good result.
Did he roll over?
He did eventually. He did eventually, yes. Initially, he just denied. But eventually, for some reason, it must have been, you know, something that we asked or said or whatever it may have been, that he eventually did make full admissions. And it was, you know, it was a really good outcome. Given this, the seriousness of what he'd done, and the likelihood of doing that, you know, performing that sort of behaviour or activity again would certainly have been high, particularly had he have gotten away with that particular incident. And it was, yeah, it was really quite a brazen thing to have done. So that was a really good outcome in it. And, you know, he sort of spent some time in jail, and then my understanding is once he did get out, then he was deported. So, so that was a really good story. And the people, the victim survivor was really grateful, and it was nice to have that win. But I think I've got you made a statement before I sort of talked about this, and it sort of really is something that I feel strong about. And you talked about, you know, winning the game, and I think for me it was really exactly what it became a bit of a game.
Yes.
And it was like a game of chess for me. And I think what I felt in the end, which is, I guess, looking back at it, because once again, I didn't realize what was going on at the time. I just knew that I wasn't the person I wanted to be, and I didn't like looking in the mirror very much. But I felt like it was a game of chess, but unfortunately, the pawns were actually people, and they became arguably a little bit expendable if it meant that I could win the game of chess. And that's probably the best description that I can give of how I felt my police career, what it evolved into.
Which is quite sad, isn't it? Because it isn't a game, and I hope I didn't I can't remember what I actually said, but I think I did say something like it is like a game, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it is. And you're right.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be, because as I said, it's people's emotions and feelings and, well, their lives, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But then that exactly that that being able to identify somebody through a bloody coffee cup.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it was you know. Oh my, that is a great story, a great story. And so we are talking about your decline now.
Yeah.
How long into your career did you start thinking there's something wrong here? Next week, Dave shares with us the moment that he realised it was him who had the problem, not everybody else as he thought, and how one woman's desperation to help him, and which he initially took as interference in his life, actually saved it. Dave tells us of the anguish, almost torture, that he encountered in organising for a petrified interstate witness to come to Melbourne to give evidence, and the anger that he felt at how she was treated by the system. To the point he went home that night and advised his superiors it was his last shift. He'd had enough. But then he was managed so well by his superiors that he was able to return to work. But it certainly wasn't smooth sailing. One day, 30 minutes into his first shift at a new station, the phone began to ring and he watched it and he realised he was finished for good. He just could not answer that phone. He froze. His time was done. But we've often heard that saying, haven't we, that when one door closes, another opens, and open it did for Dave. Dave now has many strings to his bow, one of which has been to start up a group with his mate Cleve called TJF, The Journey Forward. What a great initiative. Have a listen next week to hear more about this wonderful idea, which is helping others see life more positively. Thank you and have a great week. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.